TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. Join more of the things you love with TCL. These two guys have Minnesota sports flowing in their veins. Mackie and Judd on Score North and ScoreNorth.com.
Hey, everyone, and welcome in to the Mackie and Judd Show. Quarantine edition, day four here. Real quick, before we dive into Judd's keys to a Vikings victory and to Action Movie Rewind Halloween, the original, and also we'll wrap with Royce and get his thoughts on 76-year-old Tony La Russa now managing the White Sox for a second time. How long does it take a guy to get a damn COVID test back in the state of Minnesota? Judd and I have been waiting for like 3 days for these saliva tests back. So we're just quarantining and hibernating, basically.
It's not bad, though. I mean, I'm stuck at home, but I got a TV.
You're basically just living the life you normally would, right?
Don't tell anybody, okay? Okay, but I mean, yeah, it's not the worst thing.
The doctor's like, Judd, we're going to need you to quarantine. No.
Post show, I might have to go take a nap. I mean, come on. How ridiculous is that? I would go for my run ordinarily. Oh, no, I wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't. It's true. The good news is Declan is feeling a lot better today, and it seems like you're sort of past the worst of it. So that's awesome to hear. Federated is here helping business owners, and Federated is here in the state of Minnesota going back to over 100 years, supporting business owners and understanding that local businesses are really the heart of our communities. And you guys are going through a tough time in 2020, especially certain industries. So if you're looking for that peace of mind, if you're just looking for frontline protection and resources as a business owner, federatedinsurance.com has a ton of great resources for you to check out. That's also where you can find your local marketing representative. Also, they've got takes on Twitter, too, just like we do, at FederatedINS for fresh, relevant risk management content on a variety of topics. So Federated Insurance. Owatonna, Minnesota, since the early 1900s. Remember, at Federated, it is always our business to protect yours. And what's that I hear? Yonder? Are those Judd's keys to an improbable Vikings victory?
He's got the key fob.
The plastic rattling.
The key fob to unlock your doors.
Yeah, we don't have all of our normal production bells and whistles because we're just doing these shows from home all week. But we're improvising on the fly. And Judd Zolgad Keys hopefully is well rested after a bye week, and looking ahead at the daunting task of helping the Vikings to a win over the Packers. I would not advise the Vikings to beat the Packers. I think this is a must tank game for Minnesota. Yep. How does Keys see things?
So, first of all, Keys is a realist, okay? So Keys sat me down last night and said, I can't really call this Keys to a win because this team stinks. They've got one win. So Keys termed this, the headline is Keys to a Probable Loss, all right? Because wow. Keys is a realist. And look, the Packers should score about 52. You know, I mean, with the Vikings secondary in shambles, Ngakwe's gone, no pass rush. So key number, I've got four. Key number four, let's start at the bottom, is, and this is an interesting one, because Keys goes, mines into the special teams here. Get your kicks. That's because of this. Here's the special teams angle to this game. The Packers injury report is a substantial one. Lots of names. It's very long. It's very in-depth. Among those on the injury report for the Green Bay Packers are Mason Crosby, who has a calf issue in his non-kicking leg and a back problem. Mason Crosby sounds like he's going to play and kick on Sunday in a lot of pain. If this game, let's say it's crazy. Let's say it's late in the game. It's 52-50 because these teams can't stop defensively, can't stop a thing.
Is it a Big 12 game?
It could be.
Did Texas Tech
have you looked at these defenses? There's a possibility it could be.
Green Bay's has a respectable defense.
It's better than the Vikings, but that's not saying a lot. So anyway, Mason Crosby comes out for a late field goal attempt. You know, let's say it's 48 yards. Well, the calf issue in his non-kicking leg still means that's his plant leg. And if he's got a back, that's a real problem. So the Vikings are going to need to make their kicks because the Packers kicker might basically not be able to. So that's the first one. Get your kicks. So in Keys in a probable loss, that would probably fit into the potential win column, but I assure you it's going to get worse.
All right. I see where Keys is going there. Yeah. I think, I think if the Vikings were to eke this out because Mason Crosby like had a glute cramp up or something, that would be, and then they miss out on Trevor Lawrence, that would be the ultimate Vikings thing. All right, key number two, key number three. We're coming.
Key number three. We're going backwards. It's very, very simple. Trap them. The Packers are 5-1. And as we talked about on the show yesterday, they're going to play the San Francisco 49ers next Thursday night. Okay. So just 4 days off. This is, and the Packers are 6.5-point favorites at home on Sunday against the Vikings. Everybody knows by this point, the Vikings stink. Week one, these teams played obviously at US Bank Stadium. The Vikings lost 43-34. The point being is this is, unfortunately, if you're on the tank train, this is a massive potential trap game, especially with Green Bay turning around and playing a team that beat up on it twice last year, including in the playoffs. So this is, if there's one potential here, it's that this could be a major trap game for Green Bay, and the Vikings could benefit from the Packers basically saying, we'll win this one. What about San Francisco?
Okay. Yeah, I can kind of see that angle. I think, you know, I don't think the Vikings are going to, like, I think they're going to show a little bit of a pulse, but I just don't think they have the horses defensively to keep up. But I could see Justin Jefferson having a big one. Like, I could see him scoring a couple touchdowns, Kirk Cousins throwing a couple passes downfield, a little broken coverage. You know, I could see Dalvin Cook until he re-aggravates his groin injury.
Oh, that's coming up.
I could see them giving the Packers a little bit of a run offensively in this one. So yeah, it's very rare that we view the Vikings as an opponent in a trap game, but yeah, I could see that. All right, key number
two. Keys, getting creative here. Protect your assets. That's right. Trade deadline, 3 p.m. Central on Tuesday, right? You do have, hopefully, for the Vikings' sake, tradable commodities that you, I guess the question is, are you going to play them? If you're close to a trade, I would not. I would personally make them inactive for Sunday's game. But this is the first really key in a probable loss is I think the common thinking of tanking is like, well, just go out there and lose the game. I mean, players don't do that. Like in football, especially, no player says, I am playing to lose because I know it's going to help my team get a top notch quarterback for 2021. Guys are playing for their job. And I actually believe in football, there is an argument to be made that if you don't go your hardest, you probably could get hurt because it's a bad idea. So nobody like just tanks. But Ngakoue's gone. And if you're close to trading a Harris, a guy like Riley Reiff, the question becomes, do you, before kickoff, decide I'm not going to play them because if they get hurt, I can't trade them on Tuesday? It's imperative to me that from Spielman on down, the Vikings protect their potential assets in this game. And if that means starting Ezra Cleveland at left tackle on Sunday, it's not ideal right now, but I think it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Even just like, it just makes sense to start Ezra Cleveland at left tackle, period, even if you're not protecting an asset, because he is your left tackle of the future. Or if he's not, find it out as quickly as you can and go from there. I don't see any reason, unless teams just aren't able to eat the prorated base salary of Riley Reiff. Like, do you see any reason why he's still on the team come next Wednesday?
Zero. I would trade Harris. I would trade Reiff. I would trade Kyle for sure. No, I don't. Unless you literally take them to market. Now, Harris is a little bit weird because he would get you a third round compensatory pick if he walks away after the season. So I could see if a team's like, I'll give you a fifth round pick on Harris alone. I could see saying, nah, that's not enough. But on Rudolph, Phil, or on Reiff, if you say, I'll give you a sixth round pick, take it. If they actually deem some of their veteran players to not get the return that they are trying to get, and they don't make trades based on that, in my opinion, that's a big problem at the top. You have to trade those guys. I don't care what they've done for you. I don't care if you like them. I don't care if they come to you and say, please don't trade me. You have to do right now, seriously, Dex, you have to do what's best for your team. And with the veteran core here, that largely will be tearing it down.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
And by the way, like, you'll find other guys through the draft that you like that are mm-hmm. that are into local charities, like that you can bring them all back to celebrate, you know, as former yeah. Vikings and, you know, Ring of Honor celebrations. It doesn't mean that they can no longer be part of Vikings culture and you know, like Johan Santana got traded to the Mets. That was an ill-advised trade, I'll have you know, but he was still part of the Twins family and stuff. I mean, when it comes time to trade someone and your franchise is going into a rebuilding, I guess the comparison there would be a little bit apples to oranges, because the Twins, when they traded Johan Santana, for instance, they were still in a winning window. And so that was more of a, like, we can't afford to pay him move.
Well, no, traded.
Yep. I mean, this is just, you've got to say goodbye to people and players that you like in order to build something that they can jump back up into the future. So
you traded, in his prime still, Randy Moss.
Mm-hmm.
If you can trade Randy Moss in his prime, then you can trade an older guy who's not in his prime, who likes it here. Okay.
Yep. And that brings us to key number one, Judd's keys to a Vikings victory.
Sort of a probable loss. Cause okay. I'm not going with definite defeat. I'm going with keys in a probable loss. We have all heard of the late game football term, the Hail Mary pass, right? Well, key number one is just this: prayer time. And here's why. The Packers are second in the National Football League behind a Hall of Fame quarterback in scoring. They are averaging 32.8 points per game, all right? The Vikings defense, with Ngakoue, with more cornerbacks than they will have on Sunday, because we don't know who's going to play. We have no clue. The Vikings are 30th in giving up points. A Mike Zimmer defense, they are giving up 32 points per game. Again, I'll say it. The Packers are second in the entire league in scoring. The Vikings are second to last in that same category.
Yeah.
In week one, in your 43-34 loss at US Bank Stadium, Davante Adams, 17 targets, 14 catches, 156 yards, and 2 touchdowns. That was against cornerbacks you consider to be better than are going to play on Sunday.
That's a problem.
Here's my advice. Zim and the boys, if you think that you have any chance here, there is a church in Ashwaubenon right down the street from Lambeau Field, all right? Sunday morning masses probably start 7:30 or so. Go to the church. Forget film. Forget pep talks. Go to the church and say a prayer. You are going to need it. Look at the cornerbacks who might play on Sunday against a Hall of Fame quarterback with Davante Adams, I believe, healthy and set to go. Yeah, that's going to be a problem.
So I gave you guys this nugget during one of our Purple Daily shows that we recorded here. And it's that Jeff Gladney, a perfect passer rating is 158.3. And Jeff Gladney, when targeted by opposing quarterbacks, has a 143.8 passer rating against. So
wow.
I don't see how that all of a sudden gets a lot better against Aaron Rodgers. And that is not a referendum on Jeff Gladney and his ceiling or trajectory as a player. He's just being thrown in with no offseason workouts and no preseason against some of the best quarterbacks in the world. I mean, this dude has faced Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers twice, Matt Ryan, like he's Deshaun Watson. You're just getting a PhD in some of the best quarterbacks in the world, and it will continue this week against the Packers.
Can I give you the names of the four corners who I think might play substantial time Sunday?
Honestly, you could be making a couple of these names up, and Declan and I wouldn't know.
I had to write them down. Mark Fields, the second, who was on the practice squad, and I think they brought him up for the practice squad on Monday. Now, I don't think that this guy's been practicing, so he probably won't play, but he was claimed off waivers from the Cardinals this week. Chris Jones. Okay. Mm. Jeff Gladney will play. And I believe he was a fifth round pick this past April, Harrison Hand, who actually played substantial time against the Falcons. Dantzler is out on the COVID list. Holton Hill, I think, is probably going to be out with a foot problem. Mike Hughes, neck problem. No way he plays. Chris Boyd, hamstring. So again, Mark Fields, the second, Chris Jones, maybe Jeff Gladney. Okay. Harrison Hand. Those are four corners.
Is there any way, because you know Mike Zimmer is obviously thinking about the same thing, but He's a brilliant defensive X's and O's mind. He needs the chess pieces. He doesn't have them. But you know that he's taking on this challenge and thinking, all right, no one's expecting us to do anything defensively.
Yep.
I'm going to put together a creative game plan, and I'm going to bust out something that we haven't done yet this season. Is that possible? Like, is it possible he could take – he's playing chess with checker pieces.
Right.
Could he somehow create some sort of smoke and mirrors systematically X's and O's wise, or is it just impossible?
What would you do, though? Because
– I have no idea.
Like against the Saints. So the Saints playoff game plan was great, but that took Hunter and Griffin and shifted them inside, which was like, oh, yeah, that's – but those are two really good players.
Yeah.
What would you do? Like, I think you're asking Zim to make a five-star meal with ingredients from the garbage.
Yeah. Yes. 100%. Like it's one of those, like contest chef shows, like Iron Chef or whatever. And, you're literally asking him to take like two pieces of bubble gum, a catcher's mitt and a Salisbury steak and make a gourmet meal out of it.
Yeah, it's like lunch meat.
But if there's any chef defensively that I would trust to put something edible together, it would be Mike Zimmer.
Eric Kendricks, a cornerback. They'll never see it coming.
Oh, my God.
Honestly, I don't think that'd be a horrible idea. If you can cover tight ends, I don't think it'd be that bad of an idea.
Could he cover Davante Adams for at least 10 yards? That's the question.
Try it.
It's worth a shot.
Just hold him. Just pin his arms.
So those are Judd's four keys to... most likely a Vikings loss, but we'll see what happens. A must tank game for the Minnesota Vikings in this one. Quick shout out before we jump into the feature of the week here. A quick shout out to PodMN, your place to discover local podcasts, podmn.com. You can discover local podcasts and get rewarded for listening to local podcasts, whether it's sports, non-sports. It's a brand new app. It's free to download in the Apple and Google Play Store. So we don't have our normal intro. I'm guessing we probably don't have like sound bites and stuff, which is unfortunate. But Dex, I did find a little something to kick us off here for Action Movie Rewind.
All right.
Halloween.
All right.
That's right, boys. Wait for the bass. It's not coming for a while. But we're going to dive into...
coming for a while.
Let's dive right in here to Action Movie Rewind. We decided on this Halloween week to pivot from our classic action movie genre, and we pivoted to like a close first cousin to horror movies. And we're gonna throw little change ups once in a while, like once a month or once every other month, and deviate from action movies. But before we get into the summary and we get into all the questions and details of this movie, have you guys seen this movie straight through before?
Not straight through. I've seen pieces, but I've never seen it straight through.
Wow. Judd?
No, never.
This is
never.
Your first viewing. Amazing.
But I'm glad.
Amazing.
I'm actually glad because I came to it with an open mind and heart.
Okay. Well, this is one of the, I mean, this is really like on the Mount Rushmore, if you were to ask just the public, right, just ask like fans of movies and stuff and people who've been around for 50 years, this is on the Mount Rushmore of horror movies. It's a trendsetter. You could argue that it helped spawn a long run of 80s slasher movies. So here is the summary. All right. Halloween 1978. And there's been a ton of sequels. There's a Rob Zombie remake like 13 years ago. They've got a couple more on the horizon too. But the original, on a cold Halloween night in 1963, 6-year-old Michael Myers brutally murdered his 17-year-old sister, Judith. He was sentenced and locked away for 15 years. But on October 30th, 1978, while being transferred for a court date, a 21-year-old Michael Myers steals a car and escapes Smith's Grove. He returns to his quiet hometown of Haddonfield, Illinois, where he looks for his next victims. 96% on Rotten Tomatoes. This movie was recorded and filmed over a 1-month period for a $300,000 nickel and dime budget.
Yeah.
And it generated $70 million at the box office. One of the great, in terms of just like financial successes in cinematic history, starring Jamie Lee Curtis, who was unknown at this time, and well-known Donald Pleasance, who had been in a number of different big movies in the previous two decades. Let's start with Judd Zulgad. Your key takeaway from the original Halloween.
First of all, I've a thousand, but my key takeaway, and I will say this as a praise to this film. And Phil, thank you for making me watch this film because it was genius. Okay. Like it was genius, but my key takeaway was, and I mean this as a high compliment, was the honor it paid and the debt of gratitude it knew it owed from the second it started to Alfred Hitchcock and a film like Psycho. It was Psycho.
Including some of the names, right? Was it Dr. Loomis?
Including the fact that Jamie Lee Curtis is the daughter of Janet Leigh, who is stabbed to death by Norman Bates in the shower. That's her mom in real life.
Yes.
Wow.
So you're talking about like probably the two most prominent female horror movie stars in terms of like just being icons.
Yeah. And just great scenes. But I love the fact, like, I didn't know if it was going to be a slasher film or what. And it's not. But the genius. And it also, I love the fact, too, that I believe truthfully there is a tie-in. There is a tie-in between Hard to Kill with Steven Seagal and this film.
Wow.
And it's the thing that Seagal writes before he kills one of the bad guys in Hard to Kill. And this film does it perfectly, and Psycho did too. Anticipation of death is worse than death itself.
Oh.
Because this entire film is based on anticipation of death.
Yes.
Like the deaths aren't that gruesome. The deaths aren't that hard to watch. What's hard to watch is the anticipation. I loved how this was filmed. I loved everything about, because Hitchcock's just a genius. Mm-hmm. And the music?
Great score.
There's really like two songs in the whole movie. It's this one, and then there's like another one that's.
But they're theme songs to scenes. Myers has a theme song, like, you know, when it's coming. So anyway, absolutely. My takeaway was this took a film like Psycho and paid homage to it while graduating it to a different set, a different time. I just loved it.
Yeah. Declan, by the way, you have permission to hate this movie just because we ripped on your movie. Like you can hate this movie. Just give us your biggest takeaway from this movie.
Hey, I saw the list you tweeted out last night of all the movies. I'm well aware three of the four worst movies we reviewed have been my picks, but I've also picked John Wick, which is also one of the best. So it evens out a little bit. Okay. It evens out a little bit. So three of the four are dumpster fires by me, but also very on brand for me. I throw in a bunch of dumpster, and then I just hit one grand slam of a home run to totally redeem myself.
Declan is a volume scorer in life, in horror movies, in action movies, in dating, you know, just whatever.
Yes. No, like, let's not go there. But my number one takeaway, and I'm gonna get really geeky here. And Judd kind of talked on it. It's the cinematography of this movie. Like the opening scene, where it's totally in the eyes of young Michael Myers. Like, he's stalking in the house. He's looking around. He throws the mask on. So then, like, you're seeing the camera lens through the little clown mask. And just, I have to imagine, and maybe it wasn't groundbreaking, but, like, how simple the filming of scenes were, where it's clearly, like, one long take. Like, usually so many movies nowadays are cut. And it's really interesting how, like, throughout the entire film, like, you're either in the persona of Michael Myers, or like when they're driving around going up to the insane asylum, whatever the hell it is, and you just are in, basically you feel like you're in the car, you feel like you're in the movie. So even though it's a horror film, and yes, the anticipation is what really, like, scares you and, like, keeps you going throughout the movie, it feels like you're literally there. Like, it feels very real, and I can understand. And I was looking down the Wikipedia wormhole too, and a lot of people like saying, like, this is like one of the most sadistic films of all time, just because, like, how it's shot and how, like, honestly realistic it could be.
Yeah, it is super creepy. And I love that you brought up the cinema. We've reached peak action movie rewind now that we're talking about cinematography. Is great. But you watch some of these, like, you watch a Bruckheimer movie. We've done like two or three Jerry Bruckheimer movies, The Rock, a couple other ones that we've done. I think Enemy of the State, right? Or no, that was, did we do Enemy of the State, or did I just
no, no.
different? Okay. I just watched that one a couple weeks ago. But like Jerry Bruckheimer movies, every 2 or 3 seconds, it's a new cut. And the first 25 or 30 minutes of this movie, it's like them. It's like Jamie Lee Curtis and her friends walking down the sidewalk. Michael Myers is like driving in a station wagon, creeping by, or he's like standing in the bushes and then he's gone. And it's these super long scenes. And you have to wait like 50 or 60 minutes. It's only an hour and a half movie. You have to wait like 50 or 60 minutes before he actually starts like really killing the babysitters and the friends. So I think my main takeaway, I love horror movies. And I think my main takeaway is more of a personal one, in that this, when I saw this for the first time, like 15 or 20 years ago, it set me off on a lifelong journey of trying to watch any and every horror movie I could possibly get my hands on. And my wife hates horror movies. So when I watch them, it's usually like, if I'm home alone for a weekend, I'll stack like 2 or 3 horror movies. I used to go to, you guys know that old movie theater in St. Anthony, Maine?
Oh, it's my normal spot.
It's always been a regular spot for me too. And I used to live down in that area. And I'd go down, like whenever there was a new horror movie out, I would always go see the 9:45 or 10 o'clock showing. So that it's dark outside. It's creepy old part of Minneapolis. And so I will just say that like Halloween, the original Halloween, is at the center of my love for horror movies, whether they're corny or whether they're amazing, whether they're slasher or whether they're more just like psychological. Let's go back to Judd here. Tell us your favorite part of Halloween.
So it's a character. And the way that this was done was absolutely genius, and I loved it. Donald Pleasant's character, the doctor, is the scariest person in the film. He's the most creepiest, scariest person. Michael Myers is, I mean, he's a bad guy. I get it, right? But like, he just sort of pops out, and he's creepy. But like, just from the scene where originally they're driving to the insane asylum to get Myers, and it's the doctor and the nurse, and she's smoking, which is just hilarious. And he's like talking in these sort of hushed, weird, creepy tones and stuff. I think it's really intriguing that they took a primary character who was supposed to, quote unquote, save the day, and made him super, super spooky and creepy, which is smart.
Almost like he's kind of in on it.
Yeah, exactly. But I love that. I loved it because everything they did to me had a purpose. Like there was no like character who was like, if you have sex, you die. If you get naked, you die. Yep. If you study hard, you don't die. So it was like there were assigned roles, really, really well done. And I just thought it was really smart that the guy who was supposed to come in and save things, and the doctor who was supposed to warn the town, actually, I thought he was the creepiest character in the entire film.
Yeah. So we'll get to some notes on like the cast and Donald Pleasance, but I believe I saw something on the internet that, cause he was the prominent actor in this movie, and he was an established, credible actor. And they only got like, of the 3 or 4 weeks of filming, they only got like a day or something with Donald Pleasance. And so they like filmed all of Donald Pleasance's scenes in like one day.
I said that
they couldn't afford him to stick around for like 3 weeks. So
I said that to Dawn. I said, I think he filmed his scenes in one day, because like there were huge chunks of film where he would just disappear. It's like, where'd the doctor go? Yeah. Where's the doctor? I said, I bet this guy came in for one day, and basically said, all right, let's get this done.
We need like 5 scenes. We need one where he's like shooting Michael Myers, and we need a couple where he's like in a car, and then we'll go from there.
That's great.
Declan, what was your favorite part of this movie?
When Annie dies. Easily when Annie dies. Annie annoys the hell out of me throughout this entire film, to be completely honest. She's that typical incompetent best friend in a horror film that like from the first 30 seconds of her screen time, you knew she was going to be the first to die.
Yeah.
You just knew she was going to be the first to die.
Yes.
And like when she calls out the Michael Myers, like speeding kills, and he stops the car that kicks in.
How creepy was that too?
Oh,
to stop the car, sit there for like 13, 14 seconds.
And they took so long to kill her, which was genius. Like she's going in that back room to do her laundry. You're like, okay, now? They're like, no, not yet.
So she has drugs. So like she has a joint. Yep. She gets naked. You knew she was trying to sleep with a boy. It was all of like the horror film taboos for you will die.
Gets into a car alone.
Yeah. Yep. And also, again, this, and this is me, my geekiness in me, her acting, like, especially in the beginning, was just hair pulling out bad. Like, I was ready for her to die. And also, like, I'm sorry, if you spill butter on you, you have to physically strip down all of your clothes.
Yeah,
that seems completely unnecessary. It's like you just spilled a little butter on you, dude.
I agree.
I thought
your pants don't have to come off.
I thought it was a little ridiculous. And also, like, correct me because I'm a 90s baby, but like, was it normal back in the day to have detached laundry rooms? Like, was that a thing back in the day?
I think in some states, yeah.
Okay. Because yeah, I thought that was so weird that like there was a detached laundry room.
I mean, I think it's, yeah.
So yes, my favorite part was when Annie died. Yeah. I love that part.
So I'm going to play off kind of what Declan's talking about here. Actually, you both kind of allude to. My favorite part of this movie is how the original Halloween sets up slasher movie rules. Like it's now there were other slasher movies, obviously, like Psycho and Black Christmas is another one that maybe we should review. Black Christmas was from the mid 70s.
That's and the same it was, people, right, Phil?
I think actually in reading on Wikipedia, I think this originally was going to be a sequel to Black Christmas.
OK,
but then it wound up just being its own thing. And so Black Christmas was. Margot Kidder was in that movie. She played Lois Lane in the original Superman movies the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. And it was the first ever call is coming from inside the house theme, which that made happens. A lot more sense. Like now it's like, yeah, a call could come from anywhere. Like everyone's got their own mobile device, right? The call's coming from inside the house. Yeah. Judd's in the kitchen. He's on the phone. Yeah. there's been other slasher movies leading up to this that have sort of set the tone for rules, but this movie really defined things like the slasher is impossible to kill, the horny couple always gets murdered, dead bodies are always stuffed in places where they're going to pop out and scare people, there's always one lone survivor. Last night on so AMC is running horror movies every single night all month, and last night Friday the 13th Part 3 was on, and I had just gotten done watching Halloween. And then I turn on Friday the 13th Part 3, which is from like the mid 80s. And it's literally just like a cornier version of the same formula. It's the horny couple gets murdered.
Yep.
There's one lone survivor at the end that's trying to get away. Jason is impossible to kill, just like Michael Myers. And so I just really appreciate how this movie set the parameters for like the next 20 years of slasher movies and the rules you had to follow.
The first Scream does a magnificent job of guiding you through those too.
Yeah.
The first Scream is great, which I absolutely love those. Yeah. But the first one was just great in basically saying that if you take your clothes off and have sex, you die. I mean, it's just, it's hilarious.
All right, let's go back to Judd here. Your least favorite part about Halloween.
Ooh, I mean, it's so fast. It's done so quickly. Like if it dragged on, I'd be like, it went too long, but it didn't go too long. I guess my least favorite part, and I have not seen the second one yet, but I think these questions are answered, is my least favorite part was I did want some questions acknowledged in the first one, which weren't. I mean, the sheriff's daughter dies and we don't really see him again to react to that. Hmm. We don't at that time. Now we do in the second one. Subsequently, we don't know what the relationship between Michael Myers and Jamie Lee Curtis's character is.
You find out.
But I was going to say,
husband. When that, no, I'm just kidding.
when that film got done, I did say to myself, I wonder what those relationships were or what those reactions were. But in defense of the franchise, they came back in the second one, and I think. Pretty much picked up where they left off after the first
so,
one.
So, note on that. So, the second one, spoiler alert, if you don't want to know what happens in the second Halloween movie, then mute us for a second. But the second one picks up with Jamie Lee Curtis in the hospital just being checked out for like her cuts and stuff. And it's just a continuation. Then Michael Myers like walks into the hospital and it's really well done. But what we find out in the second one is that Jamie Lee Curtis is actually Michael Myers' little sister.
Yeah.
I think John Carpenter, the director of this movie, has said he regrets making that editorial decision that it just like it didn't like they I don't think it was originally like part of what was supposed to happen. It's worth watching the second one and maybe we can review it at some point, but you do find that out. Declan, what was your least favorite part of this movie?
A couple. Why all these kids that they're babysitting? Why aren't they trick or treating? What's up with the kids being deprived of trick-or-treating? And I don't think they're too young either. Like, I was just baffled by the fact of, like, these kids are being robbed of, like, arguably, when you're a kid, especially between the ages of, like, 4 and 11, mm-hmm. Halloween is, like, arguably the second greatest day of the year next to Christmas. Mm-hmm. So...
Were they out earlier? Is it possible they were out when it was light out, like some of the other kids? But maybe. They weren't eating their candy, though.
They weren't eating their candy. Also, like, what's, like, parents just, like, abandoning their kids on Halloween to go to, like, an adult-themed Halloween night, but, like, you have kids. I don't know. I didn't really like that. And then the second thing I didn't like either was, and this is just, like, a horror film nitpick that I have, which is why I don't really like horror films, is the incompetence of people in horror films. Like, always, I can't open a door. How do I open this door? I can't open it. Like, are you serious? You can't open the door's locked from the other way. Really? You're locked inside your own house?
Well, like, she couldn't find the key. She couldn't find the key.
And that one I get. That one makes sense. But, like, how... Just the incompetence in horror films. And like, why, that part just... It antagonizes me so much.
And why at the end there did Jamie Lee Curtis's character continue to turn her back to a guy who she thought she had killed, but then he didn't die the first time, and then she runs upstairs, and she's talking to the kids again with her back turned, and then she does go into, of all places, a closet?
I feel like yeah, right. It's amazing. But like, so you've already seen this guy. Like, he's taken some punishment. He's walking slowly back at you, and you also know, like, he's walking slowly. So of all the things you could go, of all the things you could do, and all the places you could go in that spot, going into a building and then going into a closet in a building would seem like the last place. Like, I would probably just run down the street and just scream and get people to turn their lights on.
And she tries to send the kids. That's my favorite. She tries to send the kids, run down the street and call the cat. No, why don't you get out of the house?
And actually, so my least favorite thing in this movie is, and I'll read you an explanation from, I think it was Newsweek.com, did like a full dive into some of the questions about Halloween. But it didn't make sense to me until reading this, why Michael Myers was so hell-bent on killing Jamie. So again, at the time of this movie, I don't think it was determined that Jamie Lee Curtis was Michael Myers' sister. I think at the time of this movie, she was just a babysitter. Mm-hmm. And she was the daughter of the real estate agent that was trying to sell the condemned house that Michael Myers lived in as a kid. That was the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the whole time it's like, all right, so he comes back to his hometown and he visits his old house that's been abandoned for 15 years. And then he just decides that, like, Jamie Lee Curtis and her friends are the ones that he's going to kill and stalk. Like, what's the backstory? Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, even before reading this explanation, it's still like, all right, whatever. All right, there's a simple explanation for what motivates Michael Myers that closely follows slasher movie logic, in which the killer is often motivated by a combination of neglect and sexual jealousy. Just like Jason Voorhees, introduced in the Friday the 13th series 3 years after Halloween, Michael was supposed to be under supervision as a kid, not from camp counselors in the case of Jason Voorhees, but from his babysitting sister. So he's supposed to be under supervision by his babysitting sister. Okay. Could his sister neglecting him in favor of the boyfriend be the reason why he would stalk teen babysitters like Jamie Lee Curtis? But part of the power of Halloween is that it's not reducible to simple vicious motivations from other 80s slashers. Michael Myers has a strong compulsion to return to his hometown, but he doesn't immediately look for victims. Instead, he returns home. And this is where where he encounters Jamie Lee Curtis, who drops the key through the mail slot, if you remember, while he was standing behind the window. And so he chillingly just decided, because he saw her drop the key off, that she has been chosen completely at random to be stalked and terrorized. And I don't know if it just seems like, why wouldn't he just, like, it feels like he should have more motivation for who he's picking. And that's the only thing that really bothered me. But that's okay. What other things stood out to you guys? Actually, we should talk about Michael Myers. Let's do a Michael Myers deep dive here.
Okay.
What did you guys think of Michael Myers as a horror movie villain?
Well, I thought he was effective, but I mean, it was more I thought the most effective thing about the film was the theater of the mind of the fact that you really didn't know him, or you didn't like he's not a bad guy who you sort of see in action early and you're like, okay, that's the bad guy. It's this crazy guy who comes back to the town. I thought what they left you with for the majority of that film as a viewer was really, really smart. Because again, it was all about the anticipation of what he was going to do. What he actually did, horror film wise, there's six kills, guys. There's only six kills in the entire film. It's not that bad. But just the anticipation of those six kills is huge. So I thought the idea of how they wrote the character was actually really, really smart. And I would argue that subsequent horror films probably went too far and overcorrected the other way of slasher films. I almost like the fact that it's a slasher film, but it's really not. The only problem with this is, just as far as a scouting report goes, Michael Myers is a stabber, not a slasher. Mm-hmm. So, like, he doesn't really slash well. Like, he doesn't do the kill well. He's a lot of this, boom, boom, boom.
His mechanics are bad.
His mechanics are awful, yeah. I would consider him to be probably a quad-A slasher.
He's like one of those golfers with, like, a homemade swing.
But to be very clear, he's Jamie Moyer or Tewksbury-like as far as the stuff. He's a crafty slasher.
Durable. He's going to give you innings, too. Yeah. You're not just going to take him out of the game.
But he's basically a stabber. It's like, no, dude, use the slash motion. Yeah. It's like, is your knife dull or something?
I think what I don't really get about Michael Myers is, there's just randomly murderous, psychopathic six-year-old kids running around just, like, killing their family members. That's a thing.
Like Michael.
And I love his parents.
Yeah.
What did you do? Yeah. Oh, you killed your sister. No dinner for you tonight.
Yeah. It's like, you never get it. It's not really addressed.
Like, his parents are like, you killed your sister.
Okay. Here's my biggest Michael Myers question for you guys. And it's actually, I don't know if I would say it's one of my least favorite things in the movie, but it's definitely like, it's a loophole that needs to be closed. So he kills his sister when he's 6 years old. And then he gets sent to basically a mental asylum / prison for the next 15 years of his life, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Dr. Loomis, in talking to the nurse about sort of the 15-year timeline, said, I spent 7 years trying to get through to him and connect with him, but then I realized there was nothing behind the cold stare. There was just vacancy, evil. And he's just a ruthless, evil murderer.
Yep.
And then I spent the next 8 years trying to make sure that he stays locked up. So presumably, he's 6 years old, and then for 15 years, he's locked up, and he knows how to drive.
Yeah.
How does Michael Myers know how to drive? Answer that question for me.
I don't know that he drives. He's driving around well.
I thought he drove pretty darn well.
He drives well. I mean, he might have killed the car at one point.
That was his first time ever sitting behind the wheel of a car.
Well, and
the
even
first
the,
30 minutes. Of the
I mean, movie. He doesn't die too, dude. So he's got a lot going for him.
And even the therapist says, like, well, I say they're not to drive a car. He's like, we're going to get it last night. Like, he was like, I don't know why he's old time movie now, guy. That's, I don't know why I did that voice.
Everybody.
Yeah. Michael Myers, you're not alone. You're not alone. He's not driving a car.
He talk like this. Yeah. I think I might kill people too.
But you guys remember the first time you ever sat behind the wheel of a car? It was probably kind of a disaster, right?
Yeah, it was terrifying.
That was pretty good.
How is he? And it sounds like he's not exactly an Einstein here. Okay. How does he know how to drive a car so effectively? I don't get it.
Yeah, I didn't get that part either. Also, just like what I didn't, and like obviously he's almost like this invincible figure. So that's what I also don't get. Like, all right, so Jamie Lee Curtis first stabs him with one of those, you know, knitting pick things. I don't even know what the actual technical term is. So she kind of like disposes him quickly. And I'm thinking like, really? Like that was all it took? He's like, now he's down. Then he gets back up. I'm like, oh, okay. Like he's not down. Then she's like able to coat hang him. And then stab him, and you're like, oh, okay, again, the teenager, like, easily disposed of this crazy killing machine, gets back up again. The dude takes, like, 6 bullets in the chest, falls over that railing, and then he disappears. But it's just, like, I was a little confused on the part of, all right, this dude...
Oh, by the way, bravo, one of the few actual songs used in the film... Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult was a genius move.
That's a great song. It's good.
Great song. Great timing. Loved it.
Yep.
Yeah. So I just thought it was a little weird that like he's this invincible figure, but also at the same time, Jamie Lee Curtis, like I know she gets cut and she like falls down those stairs pretty good. But outside of that, it seemed like she won the battle against him for the most. Like if you were looking at a boxing ring, like she won the battle.
Yeah. She got more shots in for sure. Like he stabbed her a couple times, but the problem is, he's got the endurance. He's impossible to kill. I think at one point, I think we had. Did we ever have a Michael Myers versus Jason? No, we had a Freddy versus Jason movie.
Freddy versus Jason. I've seen that one.
It'd be fun to put those guys all in a Royal Rumble. Let me ask you guys, though. Let's get to some key questions here, okay? How would you personally handle a situation like this if you were ever in Jamie Lee Curtis's shoes and you had what appeared to be some sort of monstrous stalker with a knife slowly pursuing you. What would you guys do?
After I thought I killed him the first time, I wouldn't have just turned my back. I would have been much more cognizant of his whereabouts, because to Dex's point, I mean, you stabbed him with like a straight edged didn't look like it would kill a person. But the other thing I would do is, I'm downstairs. Why wouldn't you run out the front door? I would run out the front door. I would probably, and by the way, too, part two of that is, if I was babysitting, I probably wouldn't have left the kids alone for substantial periods of time, which when it gets to be its most intense, she basically just does. Like, she's just like, peace out, kids. Take care of yourself. So
everyone's on the road.
I would have gone out the front door. I would not have run up the stairs.
Here's the thing. Like, the other part of this that obviously doesn't translate to 2020. So Michael Myers cut the phone lines, right? Yeah. So when I sense, okay, I've been being stalked all day, the phone lines are cut, something is seriously wrong, I am now going to any house. I know she banged on a couple doors, but like, what I'm doing is, I'm going to any nearby house and asking, pleading, begging to use their phone to call the police. And I don't feel like she explored all those options. Like, she banged on a couple of doors, got ignored, and then just like went back to her own house.
And that one place turned their lights off and closed the shades. I thought that this was a tight-knit community.
No, apparently not. Haddonfield, Illinois. Very, very creepy.
I did love, guys, the midst of all of basically suburbia and, you know, houses that look nice. I did love that for 15 years, this one house just abandoned.
Yes.
And just, it's like Edina. You know what, though? This one house, there was a killing there a long time ago, and no one lives there now, and it's really creepy. It's like, what?
Like, were the bloodstains even cleaned off the floor in the bedroom? Probably not.
And the parents, again, I will reiterate, in 1963, did not seem that upset their daughter was dead.
No, maybe she was maybe she was annoying. I don't know.
Michael, what did you do? You killed your sister. Let's go in and get some Domino's.
They're like, oh, man, don't have to pay for her college. Whew, thank God. Mommy and Daddy just saved $100,000. What's the most freaked out you guys have ever been watching a movie?
It's laughable. I was actually talking to a friend about this last night after I finished watching Halloween. I was terrified of Paranormal Activity when it first came out.
Dude, that's my answer.
Yes, because 100%. I'm more freaked out of like actual things that can happen.
Yeah, dude, and like 100%.
Paranormal Activity is like actually something that could happen. So that freaks me out.
Not really. Well, maybe.
Maybe. I'm a big believer in ghosts. And I'm also like, that's why I also Signs, like the movie Signs with Mel Gibson, like aliens and ghosts, I actually believe are real.
Dude,
so, okay. Ones freak me out.
There's a scene you just brought up, like my two examples, literally the two times I've been the most freaked out in a movie. I'll start with Signs. I watched that movie in theaters, and I was watching it with, I think it was like my mom, stepdad, and maybe my cousin or something. It was like a family movie going. And there's a scene in Signs where you see an alien for the first time. It's like they're showing CNN coverage of like what's happening. And all of a sudden you see an alien walk across the screen and stare into the camera. And it was like the entire movie theater let out a gasp like, oh, my God. Paranormal Activity. That's another one of those movies I saw for the first time at 10 o'clock, the old St. Anthony Main Theater, downtown Minneapolis. And there's a scene. It might have been like the third one or second one. It was one of the sequels.
Yeah. I've seen the first
and
two.
Judd, have you ever seen a Paranormal Activity movie? Mm-mm. What's your level of desire to watch horror movies?
Is it not high. Pretty not low? High. Okay. Yeah, very low.
So I feel like once you get on this train, it's hard to stop. So Paranormal Activity is essentially like a hand recorded movie series. And you watch these movies through the lens of like the security cameras that the families put up because weird things are happening in their house or because they want to track like their kids or whatever.
Sure.
And then throughout the course of the movie, they discover like these weird things keep happening. And then it just like culminates toward the end. And there's a scene in one of these Paranormal Activity movies where there's a babysitter watching the two kids and she's sitting at the kitchen counter doing homework with her back to the living room space. It's like an open floor plan. And the way they film this is unbelievable. There's no music, nothing. It's just straight anticipation, just like you're talking about Halloween. And the camera, the dad had mounted a camera on a rotating oscillating fan. He took the fan off, but left the oscillating part on. And so the entire scene is just like this oscillating fan showing you the kitchen. And then it slowly pans over to the living room and the entryway. And then it slowly pans back. And over the course of like 5 minutes, you see the babysitter sitting at the table and then it pans back. And then it pans back and she's still sitting there. You're just waiting, like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And then all of a sudden it pans back again and you see a ghost like figure with like a bed sheet standing behind her. But it's like a little kid sized person. And it's like one of the creepiest. And then all of a sudden the sheet gives way and the babysitter finally turns around. But it's like the suspense in Paranormal Activity movies is so amazing. And I remember.
Riot?
I mean.
Is this supposed to be real or just
no? It's fictional. I mean, they're moves. No,
it's all man made and fake.
Okay. Yeah, it's fake. But I remember walking to my car after seeing this movie solo at like it's like midnight after the movie's over, Santhi Main, and I've never been more terrified to just like walk to my car in the damp, cold weather. So, Judd, what's the most terrified you've ever been watching?
I'm not a big horror movie guy, so I don't know that there is one. The worst I've seen that got kudos and people loved it, Blair Witch Project.
Yeah,
I actually went to the theater to see that piece of garbage. It was awful.
Yeah,
I wanted everyone to die. It was just I'm not going to buy this.
Yeah.
My mom took me to some type of Disney film or some type of weird film when I was a kid that had like it turned out to be scary. And I remember I had nightmares though, and I don't know what the film was, but it was like. The basis was the devil was coming for people or something. It was very
Disney movie.
It wasn't Disney, but it was supposed to be. It was not supposed to be what. Or she was surprised and thought it would be fun, and it wasn't.
Was it the Land Before Time?
I don't know what it was, but it. I had nightmares. I was probably 6 or 7. I had nightmares for like a week after.
You've basically had never seen horror movies then. Like
I've seen some, but I mean I don't. I don't purposely go watch them. If I come across them on cable, I will. It just depends. But Blair Witch is the definition of why I don't like them, because it's like people like this and I think it's garbage.
Yeah. Well, if there's any other fellow horror movie nerds out there and you want to trade some suggestions, hit me up on Twitter at Phil Mackey. I would be happy to trade some.
Can I tell you guys that I also think that there was another movie franchise that took a page from Halloween, the original, in a very small way, and I think spun a very successful franchise, and it's the Final Destination series. And here's why. There is a seed early in Halloween where a character, where they're talking about fate, and basically they say that fate never changes. Something changes. I forget the exact line, but fate doesn't. And it's the exact basis for what Final Destination is based on.
Okay.
Like it is totally based on that, which is if you escape your fate, you will suffer your fate eventually.
Interesting.
I think this film for young people who got into the business eventually had to be groundbreaking, right? Like there's a lot of things about this film that are probably very small, but they're genius.
Yeah.
And I think that line might have launched the idea for people who escape their fate never really do. They just suffer it in a different way.
Ooh. Chilling.
Jeez.
And it's chilling. Just one line. It's just one line.
Right? I love it. I love it. I've got some other facts from like Wikipedia here that I want to
throw at
you guys.
There's some great ones here. There's some fantastic ones. Go ahead.
So the cast of Halloween included veteran actor Donald Pleasance and then unknown actress at the time, Jamie Lee Curtis. The low budget limited the number of big names that John Carpenter could attract, and most of the actors received little compensation for their roles. Donald Pleasance was paid the highest amount at $20,000. Jamie Lee Curtis got only $8,000 for this movie, and Nick Castle, who plays Michael Myers behind the mask, earned $25 per day for his efforts. So congrats. You played one of the biggest villainous movie stars ever, and you got $25 a day. How about this one? Michael Myers' mask was actually a William Shatner mask from Star Trek that filmmakers painted fish belly white. The prop team found two potential masks for John Carpenter. One was a smiling clown mask with frizzy red hair, which would link back to how Michael killed his sister in the prologue. The other was a William Shatner mask, which cost the crew around $1. Although they originally settled on the clown mask, the crew later realized the emotionless Shatner mask was a lot scarier. Your thoughts on that? Was the emotionless William Shatner mask the right choice, or would you have gone with the clown mask?
For this film, I think they made the right choice.
Yeah.
For this film, I think because this whole film was about just being creepy and spooky, but it wasn't about, I didn't feel like this film was going for, and I credit them for this, they weren't going for the splash. They were going for, so I think that they did, for them, ultimately, the right thing.
Yeah. The idea for the character of Michael Myers came to John Carpenter when he was in college. He went on a tour of a psychiatric hospital and saw that one of the patients was a little boy. When he met the boy just stared at him coldly with a look of evil in his eye.
Really?
Carpenter was terrified by this child, and Michael Myers was born conceptually.
Well, that's genius.
That's insane.
It makes me like it even more.
How creepy is that?
That's terrifying.
Is there anything creepier than just like chillingly creepy kids in some of these movies?
The doctor's line, though, about there was nothing but the devil and evil behind those eyes was a great line.
Yes.
Like there was some really scary dialogue that had nothing to do with things that you eventually saw.
Okay, here's one more for you guys. And you want to talk about the difference in how popular this movie and franchise became versus how unsuccessful it probably would have been if they would have gone with the original title. So the original title for this movie was The Babysitter Murders.
Hmm.
And now that, like, I'm sure that would have been a cult classic horror movie.
Right.
But to name it Halloween and genius. To have that association.
And those kids didn't babysit anybody. They were the most delinquent babysitters of all time. I'm glad they changed it. They had to die. They got naked.
They had to die.
Don't get naked, kids. You will die.
That's right.
Should we get to our definitive bad guy rankings here? Do you guys have any other quick thoughts?
Hold on a second. I've got two more.
Sure.
So Jamie Lee and her husband, I think in 1986 and 96, adopted kids, boy and a girl, who they named Annie and Thomas.
No
so
way.
So their real life kids are named after the kids in the film.
Dude, that's creepy.
The other thing,
super creepy.
I don't like that.
Is the little girl, if you recognize her, she is in a Real Housewives, I think, of Beverly Hills. Her last name is Richards. Her sister acted too.
Denise Richards?
Denise?
I think so, yeah.
Denise Richards?
Oh, no. It's not. It's a different Richards, but her real
well, let's find this.
But she is the kid, the little girl is on or has been on a Real Housewives. It's not
okay, hold on a second. Let's see here. Kyle Richards. Oh my god,
that's the little girl.
I watch.
Yeah, I know you do.
That's the little girl. And really? Kim, I believe, who was also in it and who I think is off a rocker, that's her sister.
Amazing. All right,
yeah, awesome.
God dang it.
There's a lot of great tie-ins here.
Wow. All right. Definitive bad guy rankings. And even though this genre deviates a little bit from our action movie genre, I still think we should lump in the rankings and everything together here. So our definitive bad guy rankings to this point, Hans Gruber is number one from Die Hard. Cyrus the Virus from Con Air is number two. Brad Wesley from Roadhouse. Cobra Kai from Karate Kid. And Mr. Joshua from Lethal Weapon. At the bottom of our rankings, we've done 30 movies so far. The incompetent Russian military from Rambo 3, the muggers from Death Wish, the French drug lord from Bad Boys, Gans and Billy Bear from 48 Hours, and Sloan from Wanted. Let's start to put the Michael Myers character into context here. He's got to be pretty high up.
Yeah, he has to be.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can't not put him high up.
All right, here's the question. Let's just go through. Hans Gruber is iconic. Gruber is charismatic.
Yes.
Cyrus the Virus from I honestly think he's in this ballpark. I think he's in the Hans Gruber Cyrus the Virus ballpark. I think he's above Brad Wesley.
Yeah.
So third.
What do you guys think? Is it worth discussing putting him above Hans Gruber?
Here's my question. No, I think Hans is the best.
Yeah.
I think it's worth discussing putting him second.
Wow.
It's a complete. I mean,
I think you're right, dude. He's more iconic than Cyrus the Virus.
I think the thing that holds him back, and it's not really holds him back, it's how we define charismatic. Like, is that holding him back from being number 10?
I actually think like he's
because he's iconic is there. Like obviously he's an icon, mm-hmm. but like the charismatic does that exist with him, or do we have to interpret it differently because he's a slasher?
I actually think he is kind of charismatic because, like, you know, think even though he doesn't really talk, you know, he puts on different masks. He put on a, you know, the one time where he puts on the bed sheet to kill the one woman. I mean,
and don't forget he killed
creativity.
He killed at six of his sister. He killed her at six. Here's why I would say he's second. We know for a fact in retrospect that if you put Babe Ruth in today's game, that he would be, he'd be good still, but he wouldn't be Babe Ruth, right?
Right.
Sure. This is Babe Ruth. So I think we have to pay homage to him because he is Babe Ruth. Like yeah. he's iconic. He goes beyond iconic in the sense that he started a trend. Like it, Jason Voorhees wore a mask. I think he's second. I think it's very fair to
put him second.
I think it's very fair to pay tribute to what was done here and acknowledge that he is the Babe Ruth of what we're doing.
Awesome. All right, now we get to our overall 1 through 10 rankings here. So Die Hard is the only perfect 10 that we have reviewed to this point. Taken at a 9.5. John Wick, Commando, both above a 9. At the bottom, the worst movies we have reviewed are Shoot 'Em Up at a 2.8, Bloodsport a 3, Max Mad Max 2 at a 3.7, Wanted is a 3.8, and Rambo 3 is a 4. Of those five have all been selected by either me or Declan. So shoot us if you must. All right. 1 through 10 scale, Judd Zulgad.
I gotta give this a 10. I have to. Like, if you take into account when it was done, what it established, the fact that the idea and the writing to a large degree has aged really well, I think. I think to give it less than a 10 would be to not acknowledge what it meant. And the fact that it has, in my opinion, aged well, I'll just go with a 10.
Dex?
Might be too high, but.
It is very difficult to not give this a 10. I thought about it last night. I think initially I wrote down 8.5. Like that was my just gut, like immediate reaction. Cause I like to take notes during the film. And I said, I think it's an 8.5. The incompetence in horror films, like to me, that kind of holds it back.
But that's purposeful. That's purposeful.
Part of it. Right. So that's part of it. So retooling it after a night of sleep, it's a 10.
Wow.
It's a 10 out of 10.
They had 6 total kills in the entire film and it was genius.
Wow. Yes. Wow. A lot of pressure on me right now.
It's a 10.
It's a 10.
It's a 10.
It's a 10.
It's gotta be 10. It's gotta be 10.
Yeah.
It's a
10. And I think the biggest reason why I would give it a 10 in addition to just like the iconic nature of the film, it's one of those movies. And I would put Die Hard in this. I would put, now that I've seen Taken, which is our third ranked movie. It's one of those, specifically with the two movies we've given a 10 though, to Die Hard and Halloween. If I have nothing to do and I'm flipping around, I am all in. Like if I join that movie at the beginning, if I join the movie in the middle, it's one of those movies that I just like have to stop on every single time. And that's part of my logic. So, boys, congrats. We just gave our second perfect 10 in Action Movie Rewind. Die Hard and Halloween sitting strong. And so here's what we're going to do now. We get so many suggestions from listeners, and we got a bunch more last night. If you ever have Action Movie Rewind suggestions for us that we should add to the list here, tweet them at me, at Phil Mackey, and I will just compile a list. So going forward, because we want to incorporate you guys, the listeners, and our social media followers into the selection process, all three of us are going to bring a movie to the table every single week. And then we'll also bring in a listener suggestion, and we'll put all four of those up for vote on my Twitter account. All right. Okay. So what we have to do right now, the three of us, is, and what I'll do is I'll either just like select my own, or I'll select one from a listener, or both, because I've got sort of like a combined list here.
Sure.
So why don't you guys, let's throw out movies here. I'll compile a list, and then I'll put a Twitter poll up this weekend, and we can go from there. So Judd, what movie are you nominating?
One that we've been threatening to do for a long time and have not done yet, and eventually I think we have to do it, Beverly Hills Cop.
All right. Declan?
I'm going to go with one of my favorites from 2001, and it's an action film because the genres on Wikipedia and Rotten Tomatoes confirmed it, but A Knight's Tale in 2001 with Heath Ledger.
Knight's Tale?
Yeah, A Knight's Tale.
I actually love Heath Ledger. I think Heath Ledger had a hell of a run there.
Yes,
in
he did.
The late 90s, early 2000s. And if we ever got a chance to do 10 Things I Hate About You and it was just me monologuing, like, bring it. I'm going to go. All right. We're going to go from my selection. I don't think this is going to get picked, but I'm going to put it on here anyways. Have you guys ever heard of the Hulk Hogan movie from the late 1980s called No Holds Barred?
Yes, I have.
Sure, I have. I don't remember.
It's like a super core, like Hulk Hogan was like an action star for a couple of years. And then they turned it into an actual like wrestling match later on. And then the movie I'm going to nominate on behalf of the fans is True Lies. Zach H. recommended Arnold Schwarzenegger classic from the 90s. True Lies is in here. Love and it. So those are going to be the four that we put up for vote. And by the way, like let's say Beverly Hills Cop doesn't get selected, Judd. You can keep going back to that well as often as you want and put it up for vote here. So Beverly Hills Cop, A Knight's Tale, No Holds Barred, and True Lies from our friend Zach H. on Twitter will be the ones that we choose from. And just keep an eye on @PhilMackey on Twitter, and you'll be able to see if you like to watch these movies and follow along with us, then you can do that. And we'll do it next Friday. So, all right, quick pause, and then we will wrap with our friend Patrick Royce and talk about the White Sox managerial hire yesterday. What the hell? Yeah, we wrap with Royce. We haven't been able to this week because we've been quarantined and doing the show from home. And Judd and I are like day three waiting for our COVID test, so fingers crossed. But we, breaking news, we got Patrick Royce into our video chat here. And so we're going to wrap with Royce, 2020 style selfie video. Pat, welcome to the future.
Yes, sir. It's phenomenal. I was just telling you guys off the air. I grew up with one TV station in Folda, Minnesota, KELO, and we called it Kello Land, baby. And we've come a long way since Kello Land, I want to tell you.
And you know what, Pat? So have the White Sox. They have come a long way.
Yeah.
Tony La Russa, 76 years old, is back in the dugout.
Look for the resignation of Rob Hahn soon, although he's put together such a promising young club. Maybe he won't leave, but can you imagine how long and hard he fought with Reinsdorf to get him off this LaRusso thing. The idea that there was a decision that these three people came to is complete BS. Reinsdorf at 84 is still a tyrant, and he told them they had to hire LaRusso. You know damn well LaRusso called up. LaRusso saw that team and said, you know, he called him up and Jer wants to, this is like Polad making Tom Kelly take Ralph Houk, but that was as an advisor, not as the manager. And I'll tell you one thing. What is Tony, 76 or
76?
76. The ego's still young. I can tell you that. He was a raving egomaniac and I'm sure he's still got that going for them. I actually made fun of him. I know you find that hard to believe about his ego in, was it 83, 84? I'm not sure when. And he got a hold of me up in the press box and asked to meet me before the game. And we sat up in the stands and talked before the game because he was so offended that some guy from the St. Paul paper then had accused him of being an egomaniac. To prove it, he had to have a discussion with me before the game. He's, you know what he really got on my nerves when he was getting beat in that World Series against the Dodgers? And his daughters were in some kind of a dance club thing, and he kept showing up for the press conferences in a t-shirt from their dance club to show us what a hip guy he was. You know, instead of showing up like a manager should in a managerial uniform, he'd show up for the post-game interviews in this t-shirt advertising. I don't know if it was dance or what it was. It wasn't sports. I know that.
So Patrick, the first game that he managed against the Twins at Met Stadium, September of 1979, Bombo Rivera, Dave Edwards, and Willie Norwood were the outfielders. Just to put this into context of this guy got his first managerial job 2+ years before Rocco Baldelli was born. I mean, This is Connie Mack like.
I'll give you another one. So he managed Don Kessinger in 1979. Don Kessinger's major league career started in the early 60s.
He replaced Don Kessinger. That's who he replaced to?
Who is that? Who he replaced? I was going to ask.
Was it? Okay.
Kessinger? I can't even remember Kessinger, man. He's in the White Sox. It was so
player manager, Pat.
Okay. Interesting.
He played too.
What?
Kessinger was a player manager for the White Sox. He got blown out. I believe it was August 3rd, 1979. La Russa was brought up, I think, from the Iowa Oaks, which was the AAA team of the White Sox at the time, to manage them.
That must have been the time about that Beck was selling, too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Beck was...
A couple years after, early 80s.
But, well, Beck could do some strange things. The guy who fired him was Ken Harrelson.
Yeah.
And Reinsdorf, who was... You know, I guess that's pretty good to be on your resume that the Hawk fired you because he was one of the worst general managers of all time. But Reinsdorf said he's regretted that ever since he allowed Hawk to fire him. So 14, you won a World Series with Ozzy. You still would regretted firing La Russa then. If they were going to bring somebody back, bring back Ozzy.
Yeah.
He loved Ozzy.
Yeah. It's amazing, man. I mean, I think Tony La Russa has sort of said all the right things. He has come out and he has said, listen, you know, I'm still like energy enough to do this and whatnot. But ultimately, I don't know how he's going to react when Tim Anderson hits a 500-foot home run, flips his bat, does a crotch chop to the opposing pitcher, and then has to walk in and face Tony La Russa. So it'll be interesting.
Think even though their personalities were 180 degrees different, I think Kelly actually respected him as a manager. As an opponent, you know, as the way he ran a team and things like that. But where did he just get blown out as a special?
Arizona. Arizona. Well, he was with the Angels because he was with Arizona for a while too.
Yeah, I think he got fired there, and then the Angels, I think, didn't blow him out, but gave him the ability to talk to the White Sox about this job.
So how about the Tigers? The Tigers, because of this, they're going to end up getting the guy everybody wanted, AJ Hinch. Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. That's yeah.
And I suppose the baseball doesn't have the guts to call up the poor woe-be-gone Tigers and say, you can't do this. You know, let's let the Tigers do whatever they want to try to get 12 people back in the ballpark.
Here's the other funny thing that happened yesterday. So if anyone is wondering, well, did the White Sox consider, like, how far did they get with A.J. Hinch? The White Sox, on the email blast that they sent out to, I think it was media and fans, saying, hey, Tony La Russa is hired with the photo of Tony La Russa. Oh. They had a signature. It was like a graphic that was supposed to be Tony La Russa and then Tony La Russa's signature. And the signature was AJ Hinch in the email.
There's some PR guy that's no longer employed, right? Is that right?
Yes. And then they fixed it for the social media graphic, but somebody screenshotted it in an email.
Oh my God.
That's fantastic.
So they must have had some discussions with AJ Hinch, I'm assuming.
Oh, well, that was what I was hearing was that it was going to be Cora or Hinch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Cora would have been good too. What are the Red Sox waiting for? See if Dave Roberts gets fired.
I wonder if Cora's got that job, Pat.
Who?
Cora.
If he's going to go back.
Yeah.
They're just waiting for the time to break it. I don't know. It's kind of weird.
Exactly. Here's my question. Where's TK? TK is a spry young 70-year-old man.
I know.
La Russa's 76.
Calling him up
TK.
And if he's got the urge again, he'd blow that off in 2 seconds, wouldn't he?
That's a great column, though. It's a great column.
He's too busy snowballing, snow plowing his neighbor's driveways in Maplewood.
You call Jack Morris, you call TK. See, Pat, that's the thing. You got all these guys. You can call them. What do you think?
TK, yeah, I probably have to get
actually. I'm glad you brought the Jack Morris thing up because this is the first time that we've talked to Pat on this show this week. So, what is this? Listen, and you guys know I am Mr. Analytics, I am Mr. Lean on the Stats, but Rocco Baldelli, Kevin Cash, you've got stud first round caliber blue chip starting pitchers, 5 innings, 5 1/3. They're pitching their asses off, they're only at 70 pitches, and this, like, knee-jerk need, like waiting for one single up the middle to pull them out of the game. Like, I as an analytics guy, Pat, I'm sitting here thinking, what the hell are you guys, like, use your brains. You are a manager. You are not a spreadsheet that is programmed into the dugout. So, well, you call Jack Morris during this.
Well, here's the deal. I mean, I'm not gonna be one of these guys that say you can't do that with your starter if he's struggling. But Snell was throwing. Snell was unbelievable. He was, because he had all four pitches, and he, you know, he lost a couple of miles on his fastball. Okay, but that, with all that other stuff that he was throwing, he was just. I mean, he had that look in his eye, didn't he? Just like Barrios.
Yes.
The thing that really bothered me about Barrios was we've been waiting since 18 for him to be a stud down the stretch or in a big game. And now he gives you five great innings. It should have been a no-hitter. Each of the hits was cheap. And you go over and tell him, that's enough. I don't trust you. I want to bring in Cody Stasiak. That was idiotic. And then this was even worse. This was incredible. To bring in poor Nick Anderson, who obviously, whatever he was using to get hitters, he had an 0.55 ERA during the regular season. But whatever he was using then was not working against these good hitters you see in the postseason, because they were hitting rockets. And he ended up getting scored on his last seven appearances. It made no sense. And I'm sure that, you know, John Smoltz went off on him pretty good, and not because he's at that old school either, because I thought Smoltz had the greatest quote. He says, when the other you probably made a mistake when the other team is happy that you took a pitcher out of the game, and these guys are happy, I can guarantee you. And Mookie pretty much said that after the game. He said, you know, he didn't laugh, but he said, I was willing not to face him a third time, because, you know, he struck him out easy twice. So the top of the batting order, 6-for-6.
Hey, Pat,
struck him out all. Do you
think that what happened in that game will cause some sort of correction a little bit to going back towards common sense playing a role? I'm not saying it's going to change things dramatically, but to me, if people don't learn from that move, they're never going to learn.
Well, and I think it's just not sustainable to, because now you're going to be back. You're going to be back to bullpens of, you know, the thing about the World Series is they had, what, 12 pitchers if they wanted them in the bullpen, right? I mean, they had 10. You're going to be back to 8 relievers max. And I just don't think if you're not going to let any starters go through the batting orders three times, it doesn't work. It's not, you're going to wear out the bullpen. He had his bullpen worn out, and he had extra arms for the postseason. So I don't know. Let's Snell's not going to go 9, but let him go 7 and then try to get to the finish line. Right.
Yes. 100%. Also, like if you simplify it, and this is where, like, people who say, see, analytics are ruining baseball. No, I mean,
no, they're not.
It's ruining, like, pace of play and things like that. And yeah. I agree with that. But it's the reason why the, like, information gathering and analytics are the reason why the Rays are even in that game 6. But then what bothers me is you get into a spot and you're 5 or 6 innings into this game, and you have a choice between a bona fide first round pick, a guy who was a Cy Young Award winner who had an ERA of 1.5 2 years ago, or a reclamation project that you've definitely, like, built into this good reliever, but he's never been in a spot like this. And it's like Cody Stasiak and Matt Whistler and Nick Anderson. It's great that these teams can turn these guys into great relievers, but when it comes down to World Series on the line and Mookie Betts is at the plate, I'll take the bona fide stud guy who has a Cy Young Award in his back pocket.
He should have talked to the manager of the Twin City Shark, the Tri-City Shark, because when Nick was at the end of a fantastic year with the Tri-City Shark, they started him in the game. They started in a game against the elimination. They had to win this game to advance to the state tournament. And Nick gave up 8 runs that day. He was wild. He couldn't throw any strikes. Now the legend is he was pretty hungover, Nick faltered that time, and maybe that's what happened. No, I don't know. It's just here. You know, I got to go back to Barrios' game, because my big problem then was, how are you going to get to the finish line now? You know, how are you going to get to the finish line? Same thing with Maeda. If you take him out now, you're going to have to use Sergio Romo to get to the finish line. And sorry, that act has run out of steam by the end of the season. The, 55 out of 56 pitches being sliders. And I'm thinking the same thing for this guy. If you're going to get to the finish line, you got to use Aaron Loop, right? I got my choice between Blake Snell and Aaron Loop.
Yeah, and Pat, the other thing we talked about too is like, and this is what a manager is supposed to be able to decipher. It's the things that you don't see in the stats.
Yes.
Kevin Cash and Rocco Baldelli are guilty of assuming that all of these pitchers are going to perform and their heart rate is going to be the exact same in the middle of May as it would be in game 6 of the World Series. And there's some guys that just can't, and maybe Nick Anderson, Nick Anderson might be one of those guys. If you determine that this reliever gets a little excitable, let's try and craft this game and this strategy so that guy doesn't have to pitch in the eighth inning. And they don't think about that. They only think about what their numbers have been in these situations.
Yeah. I was stunned, and I called Jack, not because I knew what Jack would say, but I was thinking, people are going to be saying, well, I wonder what Jack thinks about this. So I called him and he said, you're like the fifth guy to call me in 5 minutes. And I said, I only need 2 minutes. And he said, no. Well, first he said, I said, Ricey. And he said, I wonder what you want to talk about. But I mean, he was just, he was resigned more than bitter. He was just, I just don't get it. Mookie, he just struck Mookie out twice. Why do we have to get him out of the game so he doesn't face Mookie?
It is amazing. We're sitting, it's like 29 years ago this week, and John Smoltz is on the call of the game. Same day.
Yeah, Smoltz on the call, and Morris, is watching.
Pat, can you imagine, like, what if in 2020 Jack Morris is on the mound, like the 30 years ago version of Jack Morris, and Tom Kelly walks out of the dugout 2 steps after that single?
Even if it's 2 outs in the eighth, if he's throwing his best and he comes to get him, that's good. He'd still be sitting refusing to give him the ball.
Yeah. Jack would have said, sit down. Go back and sit down.
Well, he basically told him that in the dugout, That,
yeah.
When he said, hey, great job. And he says, I'm going out for the
tip. So if that game is played now, Patrick, when do those guys get yanked? Because there's no way that they get as far as they did.
Probably when Smoltz got yanked. I mean,
But I'm saying Jack doesn't get penned.
The mentality was then, Jack might have got hooked after Lonnie Smith. I don't know.
Yeah. Right? Rocco would have hooked him for sure.
Yeah.
Or at least tried.
Might not have let him go that far, Might not let him go that far. All right, I got something else that I really got, I'm upset about. Friday night college football. Yeah. I am not programmed to remember that the Gophers are playing a football game tonight. We do not need Friday night college football, even in a pandemic.
Do you oppose Tuesday night Maction?
I don't think he cares.
Obviously. They're trying to give the Big Ten Network as many games as they can because they missed 3-4 weeks for the sponsors, right? But unbelievable! How do you love those Nebraska guys? They wanted a forfeit. Damn it!
Did you see? So Nebraska wanted a forfeit, and then they tried to set up a game with UT Chattanooga this weekend
without telling the Big Ten. Yeah. They were trying to do it.
And the Big Ten said, "Buzz off! You're not playing." It's just fantastic. They're going to get screwed at every turn because they keep trying to like make up their own rules in Nebraska.
What has Nebraska done in 10 years in the Big Ten to have clout to like just try and go rogue?
Yeah, plus Nebraska also said that. We have to play as many games as we can for college football playoff, did you see yourself at Ohio State, boys? You don't have to worry about it. Okay? That ain't happening. Don't worry about it. But with this Wisconsin thing, the Gophers, as bad as they were against Michigan, are now the favorites to win the West, aren't they?
They could be. Yeah.
Wisconsin might only get, if Wisconsin only plays 5 games, they're not eligible.
Yeah,
and if they have to play, and if they come back without with a fourth string quarterback, all the Gophers have to do is beat Purdue, basically.
Yeah. I don't think that the Gophers are capable of losing tonight, even if they try to lose tonight. Oh, I think Maryland's that bad.
They only gave up 40 some to Northwestern, which went 0-9 last year. That's a pretty good indication they got some problems.
Oof. So, all right. Well, Skyuma, roll the boat. Go Gophers.
StreamYard, tonight. Huh? Okay. Hey, this didn't turn out too bad, StreamYard.
It's pretty good. We got we should keep doing it this way. This is great. And I think sometimes your phone cuts out and people get mad. So this could be okay the fix
today?
For that, too.
Was it okay today?
Good. Yep. That's so we'll officially say goodbye to our podcast friends. And we'll talk
God
to Pat next
love
week.
Kello Land. Goodbye.
See you guys. All right. That's a wrap on Mackie and Judd. Join us for Vikings Ventline on Sunday on the Purple Daily Podcast YouTube page. See you guys.